This is the son of PCJ. On shortwave, satellite, and the internet, this is Media Network Plus.
Hello, I'm Keith Perron, and welcome to this special edition of Media Network Plus. Today, we won't be bringing you news or our weekly propagation report. Instead, we're putting the focus on a man who is credited with bringing down communism in Eastern Europe. That is legendary Voice of America broadcaster Willis Conover. Now, I know that there are many of you right now listening who remember listening to jazz and Now Music USA on The Voice of America that was produced and presented by Willis Conover. Myself, I was a regular listener. Even though the VOA never targeted its broadcast to North America, it was very easy to pick up broadcasts for Latin America, the Caribbean, Europe, or Africa. So in the 1980s, I remember vividly, if I was not able to listen as the program was going out live, setting up a recorder with a timer, an old-fashioned timer, yes, an old-fashioned timer, so I can set it to record the program. For those who are familiar with the weekly jazz show that I do, Jazz for the Asking, as you probably have gathered, yes, I was influenced by Willis Conover. At the same time, many musicians in Eastern Europe were influenced by Willis Conover. You can travel to countries like Ukraine, Poland, Hungary, Lithuania, even Russia, and come across jazz musicians. And if you ask them, what sparked your interest in jazz? Many of them will say, listening to Jazz Hour on The Voice of America. On today's program, we're going to be looking at this man who had such an impact on people's lives and influenced a whole new generation of musicians from Eastern Europe. We're going to be joined in a few moments with Marie Chiliberti, someone who worked with Willis at the VOA for many years. Now, for those of you listening right now who are too young to know who Willis Conover is, take a listen to this. And this is a good example of why he is so special.
Good evening, Willis Conover in Washington, D.C., with Music USA, Part 1. The Voice of America presents The Big Bands. Tonight, Benny Goodman. Washington, D.C., with The Voice of America Jazz Hour. On the night of December 7, 1956, Lester Young performed at Olivia Davis's Patio Lounge in Washington, D.C. The pianist, Bill Potts, the bassist, Norman Williams, the drummer, Jim Lutt, a Washington, D.C. rhythm section for Lester Young. With Young's permission, Bill Potts recorded the performances of that evening. Volume 1 has been released and broadcast. Tonight, selections from Volume 2 and Volume 3. Lester Young in Washington, D.C., 1956.
In one of the high schools I attended, up around Buffalo, New York, an upperclassman wrote a skit about that presumably took place in a radio station, and I was given the part of the radio announcer, and I read my little bit, and afterwards people said, "You sounded just like a real radio announcer," and I said, "Oh," because at the age of 14, you're not too sure where you've been, let alone where you're going, and this was an indication of where I might want to go professionally, or at least where I wanted to go after I left home. And then a couple of years later, I took part in a spelling contest for three states down on the eastern shore of Maryland and wound up in the finals, which were broadcast on a Wilmington, Delaware radio station. And I came out in the last three, and the announcer for the program came out of the control room and said, the engineer was saying, "Boy, listen to this fellow talk, and if you ever want a job in radio, come to us." It happened that I came back to him when I wanted a job in radio, and he didn't remember me, but at least he decided for me that that was what I was going to try to do. Working in radio, I found in putting records together to make programs that certain records sounded more interesting to me than others. They had more vitality, more excitement, more, I don't know what it was. And I played those more and more often. And after a while, a fellow in a nearby record store, a clerk who was also a musician, said, "Since you like these records so much, why don't you get this magazine and find out what it is you're playing?" And the magazine was Downbeat. And I found that what I was playing was called jazz. It just happened that way. Of course, Downbeat and other publications and other founts of information and guidance, whether they're published or spoken, can only indicate a direction for your understanding and your taste to go, and it's very useful at the beginning. After you learn what the consensus is on the music you like, if you're anybody at all, you begin to break away from what other people think and feel and develop your own feelings about it, still retaining what you have felt from what they told you should feel originally. I was not entirely in love with the requirements of commercial domestic broadcasting. And so I tried to balance my programming activities with what they wanted part of the time, but also at my insistence, some time to play what I wanted the way I wanted to. This still caused an argument with a station manager at least once a week. So when I heard that the Voice of America was deciding to do a jazz program, I called, or as a matter of fact, I asked a friend to call, a friend in the State Department, whom I knew only as a friend, but I recall that he was also in the State Department. I thought that a call from him might get in on a slightly higher level over there, and he called, and fortunately, he reached the one person in authority at the Voice of America who knew and liked jazz, and that was John Wiggum. And John invited me over, and we talked, and we both knew immediately that we both knew about the music. And from there, I won't say that the sailing was smooth, but it wasn't as difficult as it had been in commercial radio. A program is like a symphony. A composer will take notes and put them together. All I can do as a non-musician is to take records and put them in a sequence that builds a structure that reflects and stimulates my feelings. Mm-hmm. And fortunately, I'm in a position to do it so that other people can share it with me. But there comes a time in such a program when only a certain performer doing a certain kind of performance is the right performer and performance to follow the record that preceded and to precede the record that follows. And at this point, I'm simply not going to go to the top 40 list. It's the only completely happy job I've ever had, Jerry.
Wonderful.
They have they've not only left me alone, as they promised, assured me that they trusted my taste and experience and ability, but they've supported me by keeping other people from jumping on me or from interfering with what I did.
To Willis that his program truthfully had the impact that it did. He had no way of knowing, of course, the impact he would have on Eastern Europe, the Baltics, USSR, Cuba. And it hit him in 1959, and it's described in a Reader's Digest article about his trip to Poland. And he used to be one of his favorite stories, but when he came to Poland they were out on the tarmac, he saw these crowds and he thought maybe there was some dignitary from the Communist Party on the plane or something that they were greeting. There were people holding up banners and he just didn't know. As he came out, there was a band that started playing, Dixieland. He said, "What is this?" It was for him. And when he went to go into Warsaw, they had kids on motorcycles and scooters that were escorting him into the city as if he was some potentate or some huge figure. He had no idea at that time. It hit him again when my report came from the Soviet Union, from the exhibit. And I think that he had had about 6 letters at the time from USSR, and they'd have to be smuggled out. There probably were thousands, and they never let them come through. So they had no idea here in D.C. had no idea of the impact that his programs had in the Soviet Union. We would have people come up and say, I speak English because I listen to Willis Conover on the radio. He is hero. I said, that's wonderful. You know, I didn't know who he was. They could have come up and said, do you know Joe Blow? No, is he from Tokyo? I don't know. And but I did get into this mystical connection that he had with them. I can remember in Tbilisi walking up this street, you know, because it's mountainous and they have, you know, very hilly streets. And we were walking up this crooked street in Tbilisi, and it was a hot summer evening. And from every window, his program was playing. And it was like hearing it in stereo. And we're walking up this thing, and I think it was Ellington that was playing. And by the, you know, time, and all these people in all these houses were listening to Willis Conover's program. I think it was at 11 o'clock at night. It was late. But I'll never forget that sensation. And a group of jazz musicians in Moscow drove me outside of the city and, you know, and picking me up in a car and then putting me in another car. And we ended up at the Meat and Milk Institute. What the heck was it? And there assembled was a jazz quartet. And they played a concert for me. And they said for me to go back and tell them how they love Willis Conover. This is what I found. And as I said, back here in D.C., which I found out later after I met Willis Conover, and they were talking about taking his program off the air because they said, should we be entertaining people in the Soviet Union with this music called jazz? So, as I said, if you talk about research or guides for programming, you have to be there. You have to talk to people there. And you in a communist society, they are more reluctant to tell you, except the ones that, as we found, during that time, they had what they called the golden youth, Zolotaya Molodyozh, that were all tuned into things that were Western. They had guys walking around like the Beat Generation. So it was an incredible time of my life, and of course it changed me forever because I did study with Willis Conover. He was a teacher, and he taught me everything. I used to go and listen to his programs in the studio when Stan Getz used to come in, or Louis Armstrong used to come in, or Woody Herman, or any of the ones come in for an interview. He'd call me up on the phone. He'd say, come on, Stan Getz is here. And this is my education. So then after I came back, because of this incredible popularity of his show, we did play Willis Conover's show at the end of the Russian programming. It went on about 1 or 2 in the morning, in which we would translate some of the things he said. Mm-hmm. Later on, I was very fortunate to do a Conversations with Conover show with him, which went on for 10 years, which was a departure from his usual. I mean, he was meticulous. He listened to every single thing. He constructed the entire program. This kind of thing that you think, oh, well, it's just a jazz show. I pull out an album and I put it on the air. No, nothing like that. He was, and as far as timing was concerned, textures were concerned, how one melody went to the other, there was a total method in this madness of putting together the show. Our show was improvisational. I'd walk in the studio, he'd say, pack of records, I think maybe we can take this, this, and this. And then in the middle of the show, he would think about something else, and then we'd go off into something else. And it was like sitting across from an encyclopedia of jazz. And we got him, you know, on tape. I took the program back, and then I redid it, translated it into Russian, got a voice to simulate the same kind of conversation that we had in English to be in Russian. So Willis was always, when I did research on his biography in the National Archives, he had done a series of television, things for television. He had videos in which he interviewed Red Norvo or at the Baird Auditorium, and he was already branching out at that time because he knew that there was something else. So he was always very conscious of that and did not want to just stay in the one comfortable place where he was. That's why he would go to cover concerts. The Newport Jazz Festival concerts were amazing. He went out to the universities and to Towson and to North Texas State, which has most of his papers right now because he had a special love for them, and University of Illinois, John Garvey, and would do different things, not just the records. He would do interviews, his memorable interview with Irving Berlin, with Bill Evans. So there was always a thing of not being staying in one place and branching out. When he did the Russian language show with me, he branched out to the Polish service, and a Polish lady did one with him, to the Romanian service, where Gabriela did one with him. So it was always in the thing of always searching for a new way of presentation.
There's a name that I'm going to mention who you may not know him. He went on the air by the name of Karl Yegorov. He was a broadcaster with Radio Moscow, and he did a show called Jazz Show. After the collapse of the Soviet Union and Radio Moscow became Voice of Russia, he started using his real name on the air, which was Carl Watts. And he continued doing Jazz Show. And I found out a couple of months ago that he was a listener of Willis's show when he was doing Jazz Show on Radio Moscow. And somebody that worked with Carl said, you know, he would record Jazz Show on a Wednesday. And where he was living in Moscow, because of the jamming, he couldn't hear it. But he had a cousin that lived outside of Moscow that would record it off the air on open reel tape, get the tape delivered to his house in Moscow. He would listen at home and then get ideas what he would do on his own show.
But that's the way that they used to listen also, mm-hmm. as many people found out when, based on information that we had given them, that they would go out to the dacha. They would go outside the city, and they would record it. And then they would make copies of it and give it to other people. They had an entire samizdat. Can you imagine people typing painstakingly Solzhenitsyn's novels and his works on a typewriter at all hours of the night just for this whole samizdat thing, and then they would go from one to the other, hand to the other? I mean, that's nothing that we have within our comprehension. We have nothing in our comprehension that the saxophone would have been banned by the Communist Party as a decadent instrument of the American bourgeoisie. What the hell does that mean? Excuse me, what the heck does that mean? But we here in America, don't, when you talk about it, it's like we were talking about the last trip that we made to Venus or Mars. But they were on our planet, and he did touch them. And it was almost like I've seen it described as a religious experience, and that he was a preacher, and that they listened to him and as an icon.
I know the day. I know the night. I know the skyline in early light. The empty streets before the dawn. The playgrounds. When the kids are gone, the harbor bell. I know them well. What does it mean? How much is real? The things I see, or the things I feel? Perhaps the world is what it seems. Believe your eyes. Forget the dreams.
Legendary Voice of America broadcaster Willis Conover on this special edition of Media Network Plus. And with that, we've come to the end of the program. If you'd like to get in touch with us to let us know what you think, our email address is mnp@pcjmedia.com. That's mnp@pcjmedia.com. You can also check out all past editions by going to our website, www.pcjmedia.com/Media Network Plus, all one word. We're going to leave you with one of Willis Conover's favorite recordings of all time, Billy Strayhorn's Passion Flower, recorded in 1941 by the Johnny Hodges Orchestra. So until next time, friends, this is Keith Parent on behalf of Paulette McQuarrie and Dan Hensley, saying 73s to you all and 88s to the ladies. Thank you.